Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So it's the one prat, lunar observance day, full moon, at our Padimokkha recitation. Ajahn Karunadhamma chanted the Padimokkha. So it's a day of recollecting precepts. And in Thailand, the one prize followed a little bit differently here. Here in America, at Abhayagiri, people come and undertake the eight precepts in the evening time. So I guess you could go eat dinner and then come and take the eight precepts afterwards if you wanted to. In Thailand, everybody goes to the monastery in the morning. The one prat is the weekend for most of the people in the village. So they take the day off and come to the monastery in the morning. And usually they'll help with the meal offering, and monks will come back from alms round. There's some time for meal preparation, and then it's the meal offering at maybe 8:30, 9 a.m. at Wat Nanachat, Wat Papong. Then either the senior monk or another ajahn will give the talk in the morning while all the monks sit with their bowls full of food in front of them for an hour. And you can watch your mind that time. Food's getting cold. You think this is ridiculous, but it's a tradition. So then have the meal, the cleanup. At about 1 p.m., usually the lay people will then come together in the sala, meditation hall, start practicing sitting and walking meditation till about 5 p.m., at what time they'll have a break for tea. Usually the monks are at their kutis that time. But the lay people in Thailand, they're very diligent, so they, especially like living at Wat Nong Papong, they seem to have their own schedule. They start at 1 p.m., and then they go have tea at 5:30. Then at Wat Papong, it's at 6:15. Everybody comes together for evening puja, chanting, meditation. And then after the chanting and meditation, there will be another talk. And then the all-night meditation vigil. On some occasions, there will be all-night Dhamma talks. Actually, when I was in Thailand from 2008 to 2012, there seemed to be always all-night Dhamma talks somewhere. You could go to all-night Dhamma talks almost every night if you wanted to. Just go to a different monastery, and it doesn't even have to be the one prat. On the Katina, they have all-night Dhamma talks. We don't do that yet here. Yet. Maybe in the future. It was also the tradition that it was kind of the house style at Wat Papong, that any, either Lungpo Cha or at any branch monastery on the Wan Pra, the Ajahn would give about a 6-hour Dhamma talk. So probably won't do that tonight. I don't know if I could talk for 6 hours. But when we had the Katina at Pujumgam, Lungpor Kampan showed up and gave a 7-hour Dhamma talk, so I have experienced it. It was all-night Dhamma talks, and there was only two talks. It was the 7-hour Dhamma talk followed by the hour and a half Dhamma talk. Lungpar Kampan followed by Tanajan Tawin, two senior Wat Pa Pong Ajahns. That would have been Pansa, my eighth Pansa. That would have been 2010. Yeah, Pansa 2010. I see these Isan people, the people in the Northeast. They're quite kind of tough farmers, most of them. And I remember Lungpar Kampan was giving this 7-hour Dhamma talk, all in Lao. I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And then Ajahn Tawin showed up at midnight, and because I had gone around and invited these different Ajahns to come to the Pujamgam Katina, not really expecting any of them to show up, but really happy to see Lungpar Kampan show up. And then Ajahn Tawin shows up at midnight, and he's kind of like, oh, Ajahn Kampan's giving a talk. I'm going to go take a rest. This is going to be long. So he's sort of just being a Isan boy, just lays down on the rocks and falls asleep right outside of the sala. Just like on these like really uneven, like not level at all, like bumpy sandstone rocks, and just his robe is just over him, and he's just, okay, I'm going to take a rest before I have to give a talk. So Lungpar Kampan's talk finishes up around, it was 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. So it's about 3:30 or so in the morning, and his talk is wrapping up. And people are kind of walking by Ajahn Tawin. He's just sleeping on these rocks. And sort of about 3:30, I'm kind of walking by, and you see the robes kind of start moving, and he gets up, and then Lungpar Kampan finishes his talk, gets down, and Ajahn Tawin kind of puts his robe on and gets up and starts talking. So kind of Isan style, just crash out on the rocks when it's your turn to give a talk, wake up and get onto the Dhamma seat and start talking. So I'm not really sure why I told that story, because it has nothing to do with what I was really going to talk about this evening. I guess it's just going into the theme of what it means to be a samana, and kind of calling into question, I guess, in the West, it's kind of new. Buddhism is something that's new, that's coming into a Christian paradigm, a Judeo-Christian paradigm. Even if we don't consider ourselves Christian, we're brought up in this way. Like, for example, I never went to church. My parents never took me to church, but I can still say I was brought up in a Judeo-Christian paradigm, in a Judeo-Christian society. So, whereas in Thailand, Buddhism's been there for 1,000 or so years, and even the language, the whole culture is built around Dhamma, at least some sort of understanding of Dhamma, even though for most people it might not be completely correct, still the culture is built up and built around the paradigm of the Dhamma. And so it's kind of interesting bringing it to the West, because when we read the suttas, we might have all sorts of ideas about what a monk should be, what a samana should be, or what an arhat should be. And then if we take up the training, ordained as an anagarika, as a novice, as a bhikkhu, we might see senior monks, senior Western monks, senior Thai monks, and be judgmental, critical. It's very easy to get into that mindset because maybe they don't match, you know, my idea of what an arhat should be, my idea of what a sotapanna should be, my idea of what a samana should be. So I found when I went to Thailand for 1 year for my third pansa, it completely turned the whole idea I had of what a monk should be was completely turned upside down. It was just came here in the beginning, just very idealistic. And then going to Thailand is like, we're part of a very big circle, and this is something which is rare in the world, and I feel it's really particular tradition of Buddhism. We have the Krupa Ajahns. I feel it's some of the best that this world, this planet Earth, has to offer to humanity, to people. So we enter into this circle, and I remember meeting Lumpur Liam. It's just like, just blown away. And it's unexplainable why he's an impressive bhikkhu, or why he is special. It's hard to explain, hard to put into words, but it's there's a word in the suttas, like a consummate bhikkhu. And then I came back from that year in Thailand, just I felt I understand it. I understood Ajahn Pasano so much better after that year in Thailand. You know, why he did things a certain way. I kind of came back with the feeling like, yeah, if I could ever be half the monk that Lungpa Pasano is, then I feel like I haven't wasted my monk's life. And then you hear stories about Lungpa Pasano from Thailand. You know, he had a whole life in Thailand before coming here. He's the abbot of Wat Nanachat for 15, 16 years. So we have a very senior monk, the abbot of Abhayagiri, senior monk here. It's a Mahasamana. It's a great example of what's possible in the training, even for a Westerner. It's kind of rumored that some Thai Ajahns will say it's impossible for a Westerner to achieve liberation, because I remember somebody asked Ajahn Pasano that in Thailand. I think it's maybe an Anagarika or novice asked him. You know, it just seems so hard to practice, you know, like as a Westerner. Like, why is it so difficult? Is it possible for a Westerner to achieve liberation, or is it impossible? Like, I heard there's this one Thai Ajahn that said it's impossible. You have to just, the only way to achieve liberation is to, you know, do acts of generosity and make an aspiration to be reborn in the northeast of Thailand in your next life. And then you have maybe a hope, maybe some hope. You have to be brought up looking after buffaloes. It's the only way you can achieve liberation. It's the only way it's possible. So Ajahn Pasano answered, well, on a certain level it's true, because as Westerners, the net of views and opinions and judgments is so tangled that we have to be able to sort it out. We have to parse it out. A wall of views and opinions that we have to get over. And all of us who have made it past our fifth pansa, I think, will know that that's a necessary wall to get over. It can take a number of years. Or maybe we'll never get over it. You know, maybe some people never get over the wall of views and opinions. But then also, it's like, then Ajahn Pasano answering the question, saying, well, it's like, if you see that, though, then maybe there's a chance. If you see reality, you see what's actually happening in the mind, then there's a chance. So if you see clinging to views and opinions as dukkha, then maybe there's a chance. Or if you see it as an obstruction to liberation, rather than this view is right and everybody else is wrong, and if you have this view, then you'll attain liberation and nobody else will, and I'll be the only one who gets liberated because I'm the one with the right view and everybody else is wrong. So that's dukkha. Yeah, it's very easy to have preconceived ideas, like what monks should be, what a bhikkhu should be. It's like a Westerner heard about Ajahn Chah a layperson wanted to, you know, heard about Ajahn Chah, heard a rumor that he was an arhant. And, oh, I want to see an arhant. And he went to Wat Pa Pong, and he sort of went up and saw Ajahn Chah in the distance, and Ajahn Chah was finishing smoking a cigarette. And this guy completely, he just left. He said, Marlboro man can't be an arhant. So he didn't match, Ajahn Chah didn't match what this guy's impression of what an arhant should be is. But we're part of a big circle. There's a very large community of these Krupa Ajahns. And also, if we study the teachings of the Krupa Ajahns and we find out, oh, there's these two different groups. There's the Dhammayut and the Mahanikaya, these two different sects in Thailand. And then we develop views and opinions around which one is better, which group is more gang, which group is better practitioners. And it's easy. I found when I was first at Wat Nanachat, there's kind of like the two camps, like, oh, you know, the Ajahn Chah monks are Mahanikaya, but, you know, I'm going to go Dhammayut. You know? Like you always get the odd monk or novice who just walks off, and I'm going to go to a Dhammayut monastery. They're doing the real practice. But then as time goes on, I remember going back to Thailand in 2008 and then spending 4 years there. And as time goes on, you realize, yeah, it's really all just one big community. And in the community of practitioners, most of the senior Dhammayut Ajahns have incredible respect for the Ajahn Chah group. And the respect is mutual. So there's a circle of practice which transcends this Dhammayut Mahanikaya split. There's good Dhammayut monks, there's good Mahanikaya monks. And then I've heard it also, like, it, you know, it's a junior monk at Nanachat, and you always kind of tea time talking about Dhammayut Mahanikaya. All the Dhammayuts, they never work. They get to the real practice. They never do any work at their monasteries. And Ajahn Mahabua really criticizes work, you know, work projects. Or like, I'm gonna go live at Wat Doi Dhammachedi. Like, they never do any work, so we can develop this kind of view. But really, a lot of these, I found out a lot of these Dhammayut places, they're very similar to Wat Pa Pong in the way they're run. It's like at Wat Pa Pong during the Pansa, you might have period of practice, there's not much building going on. And then outside of the Pansa, maybe there's a project, there's a building project, the monks just, they all come together, they do it, they have a good time. You know, Lung Por Liam will be out there with the group of monks. And you're also learning, that's your opportunity to draw close to the Ajahn, draw close to Lung Por Liam. I found out at the Dhammayut monasteries, it's exactly the same. They're building a sala, they're building an uposatha hall. All the monks come out, they get together, they do the work. At Thanajan Wanchai's monastery, he built the entire sala by hand, using hand tools, and him and his monks together, they built their sala. And also at Thanajan Wanchai's, they've got an EM operation going, just like at Wat Pa Pong. So really, we can see that the Dhammayut and the Ajahn Chah group, really, it's really hard to find a difference, actually, if you really see these Dhammayut monasteries. It's easy to judge one is better than the other if you've never really been there, or just maybe heard hearsay or read a book, read a teaching. But yeah, we can see they're actually the same. It's what's important is the practice, the circle of practitioners. So how do we step out of our Judeo-Christian paradigm, our conditioning? I think for me, one thing that I've had to reflect on and contemplate a lot, well, one is actually becoming reflective and contemplative is one part of it, rather than blindly assuming things. So it's like there's this guilt complex, this whole idea of guilt, which seems to me to be it's a very complex form of self-hatred, where we're judging ourselves And so there's this idea of guilt, which is a very Christian idea. Sin, guilt. You've done something wrong. You're guilty. And so there's the judgment. There's even in our court system, the judge, you know, slamming the hammer down. You're guilty. You're sentenced. So we're always punishing ourselves, sentencing ourselves. I remember when I first came here and I hadn't had any idea of precepts or really kept precepts at all before coming here. I remember coming here and learning about the precepts, and I felt incredibly guilty about my past conduct. And so the whole year I was in Anagarika, I had this very strong feeling of that I needed to punish myself somehow because I was guilty. And I couldn't see it at the time. Now I can reflect on it, that it was just this conditioning. But so I went up to Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro. They shared an office here at the time. It was in the annex. That was the abbot's office, believe it or not. In the beginning, that was the abbot's office. So I went into the annex and said, I want to offer to, there's this flags around the land. We didn't have a loop trail yet at that time. So I said, I want to offer to build the loop trail. And they said, okay. So they let me do it. But my whole intention was to do it in order to punish myself. So I went out there every day for 3 months or whatever, however long it took, with a pick and all sorts of tools and a big heavy backpack, and went out there and slogged away all day long with a pick and a shovel, building the loop trail. But yeah, the intention was, I think, not the best intention. I wasn't even doing it out of a sense of making merit. Like if it was a Thai person, they'd be like wanting to build barami or make merit. But for me, it was like, okay, maybe if I punish myself enough, then I'll be free of that bad karma from the past. But that view is off. That's wrong view. It's creating more karma. The karma of self-torment, self-hatred. So that's unwholesome. So as time went on, slowly kind of figuring this out, and especially going to Thailand, like, oh yeah, okay. You're supposed to be happy. Okay, right. So that's what living in this way means. It's like, oh, you're not supposed to torment yourself. You're not supposed to be as miserable as possible. Oh, right. Okay. Oh, wow. It's okay to be lighthearted and easygoing. That's actually okay. And then slowly learning about the training that, say, a Wat Pa Pong, it is very strict, and things will get pointed out to you, but it's not done with ill will. Remember being at Wat Pa Pong, I only got to spend a month at Wat Pa Pong the first time I lived there, because it was during my first year in Thailand. I was getting ready to head back to Ubayagiri. I had a month, so decided to spend that month at Wat Nong Pa Pong. And a very meaningful time, and was kind of getting to know Lungpa Liam a bit. And I remember one of the first days I was at Wat Pa Pong, there's maybe 40, 50 monks there, and Lungpa Liam, he sits at the, he's really far away in the dining hall, and up in front of this silver Buddha image in the dining hall, and he has all this special food that the nuns prepare for him because he's having a lot of trouble with his heart at the time. And he has these kind of like special rices and curries for him that he gets. And he had his upatak, his attendant, bring over one of his special foods and give it to me. And I had already eaten most of my meal. I was quite full, but then the Upatak was like, Lungpor Sit, this is for you. He wants to give this to you. So I was, okay. So it was kind of this like rice dish. And I was thinking, oh, gosh, I'm kind of full already, but it's from Lungpa, so I have to eat it all. And so I ate it all, and thinking like, okay, just whatever Lungpa gives me, I'll just take it all. And that evening, then the massage session with Lungpor Liam, he's like, wow, you really eat a lot. But then I felt really good. Like I didn't feel bad at all, because it's like, wow, he's paying attention to me. Just felt really good. So it's learning about the training, learning, oh yeah, this is what the training is. This is what mutual encouragement. In English, we tend to say admonishment, which kind of has a connotation of punishment or being hit. But this encouragement, mutual encouragement. So we're part of this circle, and it might be kind of easy to take it for granted if we were at the monastery all the time, or if we're in the circle of Wat Nongpapong. But then as soon as you leave the monastery, like whether one goes Tudong or even Tudong in Thailand, you realize what we have is very, very rare. Even in Thailand, it's rare. Going Tudong in Thailand for a couple months and realizing, like, that was a eye-opener for me. Like, wow, not all monasteries are like Wat Bapong. What, actually, there, some of these monasteries are kind of things that I would never imagine. Monks practicing black magic, for example, just things that I just never could have conceived of. And I always thought, oh, it's just every monastery in Thailand is going to be just like Wat Bapong. But no, Wat Bapong has a good reputation for a reason. It's rare even in Thailand. Or Bayagiri, you think like, oh yeah, you know, if I go Tudong, yeah, everybody's just going to be like all the lay people who come to a Bayagiri. But then you get out of the monastery and you see it's not everybody's like the lay people who come to a Bayagiri. This is people who are keeping precepts. And, but there are a lot of good people. There are a lot of really good people out there. There's good people, and there's people who don't have good intentions. Well-intentioned people, poorly intentioned people. It's a big mix outside of the monastery. So at first here, kind of working as an Anagarika to punish myself. It didn't work out so well, but still kind of kept at it for a while. Then going to Thailand, kind of started developing this sense of boon, of punya, this sense of kind of, oh yeah, this is about building parami. This is about these different, building up these different qualities. And it's about developing qualities where you can cultivate the holy life, cultivate the samana's life in a long-term sense, rather than hoping one's going to understand everything quickly, immediately, hoping for mastery very quickly. So as with any skill, living the samana's life is a skill that one develops over time. Keeping precepts is a skill that one develops. One inevitably breaks precepts, but these are training guidelines. So we train ourselves, we learn to see our minds. If we live in a way where we're always just following our desires, it's very difficult to see the mind. One might even think there's not desire there. But the moment one stops following it, and then there's the momentum of desire is seen more clearly. So the precepts highlight the desires in the mind. The speech precept, taking that as an example, we might want to lie for some reason in order to, or bend the truth in order to be seen in a certain way, or get something out of it, maybe receive something. Might want to make people laugh. You know. So seeing in the mind, is that really necessary? Is that, or harsh speech, you know, that's putting a check on anger. So one is angry, wants to tell somebody off, but there's these precepts against harsh speech. So that's seeing the mind, seeing the anger in the mind. And divisive speech, this is looking towards harmony, developing communal harmony. And then idle chatter is kind of putting a check on delusion and keeping our focus on practice. And then what is the practice? I used to think the practice was sitting and walking meditation, and then everything else wasn't practice. But then going to Thailand and seeing the way the Thai monks practiced, and specifically Longpor Liam, but actually most of the monks were practicing in this way. It's all four postures, sitting, walking, standing, lying down. Practice is always happening. Mindfulness can always be cultivated. And during the work period the other day, I was milling lumber with some in Arikantiko. It was really meditative. Not much thinking had to happen. It was just making the same cut over and over and over and over again. And it took a long time. And then that's, you know, that can be practice. It's something which is repetitive. And also, practice doesn't mean not thinking, too. We're allowed to use our brains and figure things out. So meditation even, or even concentration, doesn't mean not thinking. You know, not thinking might happen, but there's right thought. So why would the Buddha say right thought is a factor of the Noble Eightfold Path? Why didn't he say no thought? So he didn't say right view, no thought, right speech, right action. He said right view, right thought. Or like Lungpo Cha, there's only one kind of person that stops thinking, and that's a dead person. A lot of the time, too, if it seems like there's a state of no thought in our meditation, chances are there is thought happening, but it's subtle and we don't know how to see it yet. There's always something happening in the mind. But learning how to curb what the practice is, learning in Thailand, is curbing unwholesome tendencies and then developing wholesome tendencies, wholesome habits. The Krupa Ajahns are always using this phrase over and over, Dong Plien Nisai. You have to change your habits. So we have unwholesome mental habits, say mental habits of self-judgment, judgment of others, mental habits, desire systems. We have a default mode. Everybody will have a default mode. So it's trying to change the habit and change that default mode into something more wholesome, so that when we're quote-unquote not practicing, we default to something wholesome rather than to something unwholesome. The Buddha said that there's this one interesting sutta, and I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, which has a lot of really amazing hidden gems in it. He said, the Buddha saying, he's talking about the wholesome and the unwholesome, and then the Buddha saying, after one practices this way for a long time, even one's mental proliferations will be wholesome. So even one's mental proliferations will tend to be wholesome. And he wasn't necessarily praising mental proliferation, but just saying this is the default mode can change from an unwholesome one to a wholesome one. It's possible to have in the past defaulted to irritation and aversion and judgment. And with enough effort in the practice, that default mode can become equanimity, you know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. So after spending some time in Thailand, I still kind of had this tendency to want to help out with duties, work, as a complement to the practice, meditation, formal practice. And found after that first year in Thailand, I wasn't doing it in order to punish myself, which was good. It felt better. It's more out of a sense of building barami. It's like, okay, well, this might be difficult, this might take effort, but it's helpful. Maybe it's helpful for the community. Maybe sometimes, you know, might work in the afternoon to go against a tendency just to go back to the kuti and crash out for a few hours, sleep. So the intention starts to shift, the default mode starts to shift. It's more out of, okay, this is dana barami, this is renunciation barami. And even then, the cultivation of the sitting and walking meditation, if we have periods of retreat and diving into the formal practice, sitting and walking meditation, or the chanting, it's a cultivation of barami, a cultivation of, it's exceedingly wholesome, these activities, when we're seeing it as a cultivation of barami, rather than something I have to do because there's something wrong with me and I have to change, I have to get rid of that thing that's wrong with me, so then somehow, then I won't have that thing that was wrong with me and then I'll somehow be different. But rather it's, okay, starting where we're at, you know, cultivating barami. But then there's more shifts that happen after that. Then there's, one starts to act from a place of gratitude. And that's different again. That's the Pali word, katanyu katawedi. One starts to live one's life from a place of gratitude. And it starts to dawn on one what we're a part of with this the circle that we're a part of. It starts to dawn on one what a long-term commitment actually is, what it actually means to live the holy life, what it actually means to be a practitioner, and what it actually means to give oneself to Buddha Dhamma Sangha. We chant it all the time. It's to the Buddha, I dedicate my body and life. You know, by the utterance of this truth, may I grow in the Master's way. To the Dhamma, to the Sangha, I dedicate this body and life. In devotion, I will walk the well-practiced way of the Sangha. So we chant it all the time. But has it sunk in? What does it mean? What does it mean for each person? You know, doing that chanting, is the mind kind of generating something like, oh, they did this, they looked at me that way. You know, is there some sort of unwholesome proliferation happening? Or if one is really, really with the chanting, you know, to the Buddha, I dedicate this body and life. If one is really chanting that with and meaning it, then you can get the hair standing on end. You get this feeling of faith, very strong faith arising. It's like a defaulting to faith. Whether things are easy or difficult, defaulting to a faith in the practice. It's not practicing to sort of be hard on oneself, or it's not practicing to attain anything, but it's practicing for the sake of the practice. This is something the Kurbajans will say in their teachings, is we just practice for the sake of the practice. And this is Kanti Barami, this patient endurance. This kind of thing takes time. It's polishing the heart, polishing the mind. Or you could think of it as like there's an iron shell of delusion around the heart, an iron shell of ignorance, an iron shell of sakkaya ditti, of self-view, of clinging around the heart. And what we have with the practice, we have a very, very fine grit stone that we rub away at that shell. And it's thick, and it's going to take a long time to get through. And it seems like almost none of the iron is being worn away. It seems like we're never going to get through to the heart. But we just keep, that doesn't mean we stop. That doesn't mean we stop rubbing away at that shell. The Buddha is saying, like, the practice is like a carpenter with the rubber handle on their mallet. So as the carpenter works over the years, the rubber handle slowly wears away. It takes many years. And when the carpenter looks at that handle, he doesn't really know. He can see some of it's worn away, but he doesn't really know this much has worn away. So when we look at our own practice, it's difficult to know, you know, this much of the defilements is worn away. But then when the rubber on the handle is completely gone, completely worn through, the carpenter knows that rubber is completely worn through. It's down to the wood. And just so a practitioner knows, you know, that sakkaya ditti is completely worn away, the defilements are worn away, they'll know at that time. And as far as it is important to have some sort of gauge for the practice, even though it can be hard to discern or vague, it is good for the sake of being able to encourage ourselves. I remember asking Ajahn Jayasaro this question in Thailand, and he's saying, you know, it's not, you can't judge your practice by how many hours a day you're sitting and walking meditation, and you also can't judge your practice by how deep your meditation is when you do sit in meditation. But what you can judge your practice by is the sense of self, is the clinging to a sense of self growing weaker? Is greed growing weaker? Is anger and hatred, ill will growing weaker? And is delusion growing weaker? And then you take that in all four postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. How is the mind? Again, coming back to what is the mind defaulting to? That's how we can gauge our practice. I mean, I gave the example during the Thanksgiving retreat of, I was Tupansa, I hadn't gone to Thailand yet, that's probably why this happened. And I had a really great, blissful meditation, morning puja, and then after morning puja, somebody came and started accusing me of all sorts of stuff, and then I just completely exploded with anger. And after having this blissful, peaceful, great meditation, so that didn't mean that anger was gone. Having a good meditation, and never sort of exploded in anger like that again since then. But it was certainly like, wow, having a really great meditation doesn't take your anger away. That's amazing. So we practice in a balanced way. How are the defilements? How is greed, hatred, and delusion? Is it becoming less? Or is it increasing? Ajahn Jeff has this teaching, if you don't have wisdom, but you have concentration, what you get is concentrated greed, anger, and delusion. So, yeah, just coming back to gratitude, a sense of lightheartedness, a sense of not judging oneself and others, a sense of faith, a sense of, you know, we practice, these things are possible. It is possible to change the default mode that the mind goes into. It's possible to train one's spirit to be to be more free. You know, when we use the Wan Prao, we recollect the precepts. The precepts are a great protection for us as well, for our practice, for the practice of others, creates harmony. I'll just end with a brief Anguttara Nikaya Sutta I read just before coming in here too, another little gem. The Buddha saying there's three things that are rare in the world. One is the arising of the Tathagata, the arising of a fully enlightened Buddha. It's one thing that's rare in the world. And another thing that's rare in the world is one who teaches the Dhamma as proclaimed by the Tathagata. And then another thing that's rare in the world is one who is thankful and grateful. So I think I'll leave it at that for this evening. Dhammaya dhamma kataya padukaram dhamma se.